The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome. This is Cheryl at the Talking Information Center. Thanks so much for joining me. Today is Wednesday, April 29th, 2026, and I'm reading first from the spring issue 2026 of Taste of Home. And here's an idea for breakfast. It is mushroom and egg breakfast tacos. It was submitted by Kathleen Gill of Las Vegas, Nevada, and she writes, breakfast tacos aren't unusual, but a rich and flavorful mushroom sauce takes these simple tacos from ordinary to extraordinary in no time. It takes 30 minutes to prepare. It makes 6 servings, and ingredients needed are 1 pound of sliced fresh mushrooms, 1 cup of slivered almonds, 2 tablespoons of dried minced onion, tablespoon of minced garlic, 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, tablespoon of butter, 4 large eggs, lightly beaten, 12 mini flour or whole wheat tortillas that have been warmed, and some minced fresh tarragon is optional. First, in a nonstick skillet, cook the mushrooms over medium heat until they reduce in size and start to brown. Should take 8 to 10 minutes, stirring only occasionally. Add your almonds, followed by onion and garlic. Cook until the nuts are toasted and become fragrant. That should only take 1 to 2 minutes. Transfer that mixture to a blender or a food processor. Add the oil, salt, and pepper, and process until it's a smooth consistency. Set that aside. Second, heat your butter in the same skillet over medium heat. Pour in the eggs. Cook, stir until the eggs thicken and no liquid egg remains. Divide the mushroom puree among the tortillas. Top with the eggs and tarragon, if you so choose, and serve immediately. 2 tacos will provide 360 calories, 23 grams of fat, 129 milligrams of cholesterol, and 468 milligrams of sodium. The next recipe was submitted by Anne Sheehy of Londonderry, New Hampshire, and it's her recipe for pressure cooker salsa London broil. She writes, I love using my pressure cooker for this recipe because it comes together so quickly, but it still has that long, slow-cooked flavor. The veggies semi-melt into the sauce, and it gives it an added savory taste. Prep time is only 15 minutes, makes 4 servings. Ingredients needed are 1 to 1.5 pounds of a beef top round steak, 1 jar, that's 16 ounces of salsa, 1 medium sweet potato that's been peeled and chopped, 1 large carrot, thinly sliced, 1 garlic clove, minced, lime wedges, and chopped fresh cilantro is optional. First, cut your steak into thirds. Place them in a 6-quart electric pressure cooker. Add the salsa, the sweet potato, carrot, and garlic. Lock the lid. Close the pressure release valve. And adjust to pressure cook on high for 10 minutes. Then let the pressure release naturally. Second, slice your steak. Serve with the vegetables. Garnish with lime wedges. And if so desired, tops. Chopped cilantro. 1 serving is only 239 calories, 4 grams of fat, 63 milligrams of cholesterol, and 503 milligrams of sodium. How about buffalo shrimp with sweet potato grits? Almost sounds like some recipe from the South. And this comes from Julie Peterson, who lives in Crofton, Maryland. Shrimp and grits is a classic Southern comfort food at its best. But this dish takes a step further by adding another Southern staple, sweet potato. It makes for a fast, easy, delicious dish to serve for breakfast or lunch. One bite, and your guest will be smiling from ear to ear. It takes 30 minutes to prepare, and it makes 6 servings. Ingredients needed are 1 cup of quick cooking grits, 1 can, that's 16 ounces, cut sweet potatoes and syrup, be sure to drain and mash, 3 tablespoons of butter, 1/2 teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 1/2 cup of reduced fat Monterey Jack cheese, 1 pound of uncooked shrimp that's in the 26 to 30 per pound range that have been peeled and deveined, 1 teaspoon of paprika, 1/4 teaspoon of cayenne pepper, 3 tablespoons of olive oil, 1/3 cup of buffalo wing sauce, and sliced green onions, optional. First, in a large bowl, cook the grits according to the package direction. Stir in the mashed sweet potatoes, the butter, salt, and pepper until everything is heated through. Then stir in the cheese until it melts. Second, toss your shrimp with paprika and cayenne pepper. In a large skillet, heat the oil over medium heat. Add the shrimp and cook until the shrimp naturally turns pink and becomes opaque. That's only going to take 2 to 3 minutes, and stirring occasionally. Then stir in your buffalo sauce, heat through, and serve the shrimp over the grits. And if you choose, you can top with the sliced green onions. One serving provides 361 calories, 16 grams of fat, 114 milligrams of cholesterol, and 837 milligrams of sodium. Million Dollar Soup was submitted by Nancy Mock, who lives in Southbridge, Massachusetts. She writes, "This soup may have a long ingredient list, but it pays off in each decadent, flavorful, and hearty spoonful. I make it on the weekends to enjoy for lunch or dinner during the week. Prep time is 20 minutes, and it makes 8 servings. The list of ingredients are as follows. 2 tablespoons of olive oil, tablespoon of butter, 2 medium sweet onions, thinly sliced, pinch of salt, Parmesan breadcrumbs, or Italian breadcrumbs, 1 cup of panko breadcrumbs, 1/2 cup of grated Parmesan cheese, 3 tablespoons of butter, melted. For the soup, you will need tablespoon of olive oil, tablespoon of butter, 1 cup of chopped celery, 1/2 cup of sliced fennel bulb, 3 garlic cloves, minced, 1/4 cup of white wine, 6 cups of chicken stock, 3 cups of chopped fresh kale, cup of crumbled cooked bacon, tablespoon of soy sauce, teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of dried thyme, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 2 cups of shredded cooked chicken breast, 1 package, that's 8 ounces, of potato gnocchi, 2 1/2 cups of shredded cheddar cheese, 1 cup of heavy whipping cream, warmed, 1/4 teaspoon cayenne pepper, 3 tablespoons of cornstarch, 3 tablespoons of cold water. First, to do the caramelizing, heat your olive oil and butter in a large Dutch oven or a soup pot over medium-high heat. Add the onions, cook for 4 to 5 minutes, stirring occasionally. Stir in your salt. Now reduce the heat to low and cover. Cook until the onions are soft, should take about 15 minutes. Remove the lid, cook another 20 minutes or until very soft and browned, stirring occasionally. Transfer that to a small bowl and set it aside. Secondly, preheat your oven to 350 degrees. line a 15 by 10 inch by 1 inch baking sheet with aluminum foil or parchment paper. And to make the breadcrumbs, in a small bowl you would combine the panko, Parmesan, and melted butter. Spread it in an even layer on the prepared baking sheet and bake for 10 to 12 minutes, stirring once until it becomes golden brown, and then remove and let those breadcrumbs cool. Third, to make your soup, you would add the olive oil and butter to the same Dutch oven or soup pot over medium heat. Add your celery, fennel, cook until it's softened and begins to brown. That should take about 7 to 8 minutes. Add the garlic, cool until fragrant. Then add the white wine, bring to a simmer, scraping the brown bits from the bottom until it's mostly dissolved, another 1 to 2 minutes. Fourth, now add your caramelized onions, chicken stock, kale, 3/4 cup of crumbled bacon, the soy sauce, salt, thyme, pepper, all to the pot. Bring to a boil, reduce the heat, cover, and simmer for about 10 to 15 minutes. Fifth, remove the lid, stir in the shredded chicken and gnocchi, simmer uncovered until the gnocchi floats to the top, stir in the shredded cheese, place the cream in a small bowl, add a small amount of hot soup broth to the cream to temper it. And now slowly pour the mixture into the soup, stirring constantly, and add some cayenne pepper. Sixth, in a small bowl, whisk together the cornstarch and water. Stir into the soup. Simmer until it thickens. Should take 2 to 3 minutes. Lastly, ladle the soup into the serving bowls. Top each bowl with the remaining 1/4 cup of crumbled bacon and Parmesan breadcrumbs. Serve immediately. One serving provides 617 calories, 41 grams of fat, 133 milligrams of cholesterol, and 1,657 milligrams of sodium. I always enjoy finding chicken casserole recipes. And this one comes from the Taste of Home test kitchen itself. Everyone at the table will love this family-friendly dish. It's so easy to mix together and get on the dinner table on busy weeknights. Prep time is 30 minutes, makes 8 servings. Ingredients needed for the recipe are as follows. 4 ounces of cream cheese, softened, 1/2 cup of sour cream, 1 can, 10.5 ounces, of condensed cream of chicken soup, undiluted, 1/2 teaspoon onion powder, 1/2 teaspoon garlic powder, 4 cups of shredded cooked chicken, 1 cup of 2% cottage cheese, 25 Ritz crackers, crushed, 3 tablespoons of butter, melted, 2 green onions, chopped. First, prep your oven to 350 degrees. In a large bowl, beat your cream cheese and sour cream until it's a smooth consistency. Add the soup, onion powder, garlic powder. Stir in your chicken and cottage cheese. Transfer that mixture to a greased 9-inch square baking dish. Combine the crackers and butter. Sprinkle over the top of the casserole. Bake uncovered until it's heated through for 25 to 30 minutes. Sprinkle with green onions. 1.5 cups of this casserole provides 363 calories, 24 grams of fat, 105 milligrams of cholesterol, and 593 milligrams of sodium. How about your own from scratch recipe for pound cake? George Dunn, who lives in Jasper, Texas, writes, "We've always included pound cake on our family menus through the years. I've tried many recipes. I can honestly say this one is the best. It has a very fine, rich texture that makes it unusually smooth. That texture plus fantastic flavor add up to a special treat each time we serve it. Prep time is 20 minutes, and it makes 16 servings. Ingredients needed are 2 cups of butter, softened, 3 cups of sugar, 6 large eggs at room temperature, 2 teaspoons of vanilla, 4 cups of all-purpose flour, 3 quarters of a cup of 2% milk. Confectioner's sugar, optional. First, preheat your oven to 300 degrees. In a large bowl, cream your butter and sugar until they become light and fluffy. That should take about 5 to 7 minutes. Add the eggs, one at a time, beating well after each addition. Beat in the vanilla. Gradually add the flour alternately with the milk, beating just to make sure everything is blended well. Second, pour into a greased and floured 10-inch tube pan. Bake until a toothpick inserted in the center comes out clean. Should take a good hour and 40 minutes, so almost 2 hours. It's a big cake. Lastly, cool your cake for 15 minutes before removing from the pan to a wire rack. That way it will cool completely. And if you choose, you can sprinkle with confectionery sugar, some fresh strawberries, and a dollop of whipped cream. Sounds good to me. One piece of this cake provides 499 calories, 26 grams of fat, 132 milligrams of cholesterol, and 215 milligrams of sodium. The next group of recipes and articles comes from the May 2026 issue of Food and Wine magazine. Have you ever heard of chicken salt? I know I haven't. Secret ingredient, meat chicken salt. It's the Australian seasoning that's great on just about everything. There are flavors you don't realize are culturally specific until you leave home. And for Chloe Braitwath, she writes, now that I'm living in France, there's a Vegemite Tim Tass biscuits, Milo, and the very particular satisfaction of a flat white done right. And then there's chicken salt, which is a yellow-flecked umami-heavy seasoning, Australian sprinkle with total nonchalance over roast chicken. Hot chips, which are fries, sorry, and just about anything else. I grew up assuming this was normal, that when you ordered fries, they would arrive aggressively seasoned with something, salty in fact, savory, and faintly sweet. It wasn't until I moved overseas I realized the rest of the world had something that I'd been getting by without. Today, many restaurants and spice producers had their own variations. In Melbourne, Japanese restaurant Choto Maru, it sells one with a Japanese curry powder. Then there's another spice house. Its version has coconut sugar and kelp for a natural boost of umami. And even Australian KFC's serves their fries with a chicken salt styling seasoning. So there are 3 essential chicken salts available in the U.S. The first is Mitanni Classic Chicken Salt. The original iconic seasoning is salty and herby with hints of garlic and onion. It's multi-purpose and particularly good with buttered popcorn. It's $15 and you can order it from Amazon.com. The second chicken salt is Anchor Chicken Flavored Chippy Salt. Anchor's chicken salt is bolder, sweeter than others, and it has a pronounced umami character from the addition of beef fat and soy sauce powder. It retails for $7 at thatAustralianFoodShop.com. Jada JADA Spices Chicken Salt. It was founded by an Aussie and produced in the United States. Jada's Chicken Salt is made primarily with salt, onion powder, garlic powder, and turmeric. It costs $9, and it can be ordered from JadaBrands.com. Okay, here's a recipe. It's for slab salad with a Parmesan dressing. Prep time is 20 minutes, and it makes 4 servings. Cut into thick slabs a head of crisp iceberg lettuce becomes a knife and fork salad. Parmesan, anchovies, and Worcestershire give the creamy dressing umami and a crunchy celery relish with capers, lemon zest, and Dijon, all of which adds pop of acidity. And you can let the relish stand for 10 minutes before serving, so all the flavors meld together. For the celery relish, you need a cup of diced celery, which is about 4 stalks, plus the leaves for garnish, half a cup of capers that have been rinsed and chopped, quarter cup of fresh basil leaves, chopped, quarter cup of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of white wine vinegar, 4 teaspoons of grated lemon zest from about 2 lemons, 2 teaspoons of Dijon mustard, teaspoon of crushed red pepper. And for the salad, you would need 2 ounces of Parmesan cheese that's been finely shredded, 3 quarters of a cup of sour cream, half a cup of whole buttermilk, quarter cup of mayonnaise, tablespoon of Worcestershire sauce, half a tablespoon of white wine vinegar, 2 oil-packed anchovy fillets that have been minced, 2 garlic cloves, grated, quarter teaspoon of kosher salt, 1/8 of a teaspoon black pepper, 1 2.5-pound head of iceberg lettuce that's cut into 4 2-inch thick slabs. To make the celery relish, stir together all the ingredients in a large bowl. Set that aside uncovered for at least 10 minutes so all the flavors combine. To make the salad, whisk together the Parmesan cheese, sour cream, buttermilk, mayonnaise, Worcestershire sauce, vinegar, anchovies, garlic, salt, black pepper in a large bowl. Place 1 lettuce slab on a plate. Spoon a quarter cup of the Parmesan dressing over the slab. The slab should really be heavily dressed. Drizzle then a quarter cup of the celery relish over the dressed lettuce slab and garnish with celery leaves. And you would repeat the process with the remaining 3 lettuce slabs and serve. This can be made ahead. That's the celery relish, and the Parmesan dressing can be stored in a separate airtight container in the refrigerator for up to 2 days. You may have had eggs Florentine out for breakfast at a breakfast restaurant, but have you ever made it from scratch yourself? If you're interested, here's the recipe for eggs Florentine. Total prep time, 40 minutes, makes 4 servings. Brown butter lends a nutty depth to the silky hollandaise sauce in this riff on classic eggs Florentine. Crack each egg into a small bowl to make it easy, so then you gently slide it into the simmering water. For the brown butter and hollandaise sauce, you would need 3/4 of a cup plus a tablespoon unsalted butter, 6 large egg yolks, 2 tablespoons of warm water, 1.5 tablespoons fresh lemon juice, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, pinch of black pepper. For the sautéed spinach, you would need 1.5 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, 1 small shallot that's been minced, 1 large garlic clove, grated, 2 tablespoons of minced Fresno chili, 8 cups of fresh baby spinach, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, and 1/4 teaspoon black pepper. And any additional ingredients would consist of 8 large eggs, teaspoon of fresh lemon juice, 4 English muffins that have been split and lightly toasted, and black pepper for garnish. To make the brown butter hollandaise sauce, melt the butter in a large skillet over medium heat. Continue cooking, swirling the skillet occasionally until milk solids are lightly browned. Should take about 5 minutes. Then immediately transfer the butter to a heat-proof measuring cup. Set that aside. And you don't have to clean your skillet. You're going to continue to use it. Second, bring a large saucepan of water to a low simmer over medium-low. Whisk together the egg yolks, 2 tablespoons of warm water, lemon juice, salt, black pepper, in a medium-sized heat-proof bowl. Set the bowl over the barely simmering water in the saucepan. This ensures that the bottom of the bowl does not touch the water. And you want to whisk constantly, gradually, the steam in the brown butter until the mixture thickens and becomes creamy. That should take about 3 minutes. Then remove that bowl from the saucepan. Third, season your hollandaise sauce with the salt to taste. And if you need to thin the sauce, you can whisk in 2 tablespoons of additional warm water. Be sure to do it, though, 1 teaspoon to a time. Keep your hollandaise sauce warm by setting the bowl over the saucepan of warm water. Turn off the heat and whisk occasionally. Don't heat the hollandaise sauce or it'll curdle. Fourth, to make the sautéed spinach, heat your oil in a skillet over medium heat. Add the shallot and garlic, chili pepper. Cook, stirring often until it softens. It should take about 2 minutes. Add your spinach, salt, black pepper. Cook, stirring occasionally until your spinach is wilted and there's no liquid in the bottom of the skillet. Remove from heat and season to taste with additional salt. Set that aside. Fifth, crack 4 eggs into 4 separate small bowls. Bring a large saucepan of water to a boil over medium-high. Reduce the heat to low. You just want to maintain a low simmer. Add your lemon juice. Stir the water in a circular motion so it gently swirls. Lower each bowl 1 at a time. Gently slide the egg into the water and simmer until the egg whites are set. This is going to take about 2 to 3 minutes. Remove the eggs using a slotted spoon. Transfer to a paper towel-lined plate, and you'll repeat the process with the remaining 4 eggs. When it comes time to serve, divide the spinach evenly among the English muffin halves. Top each muffin half with a poached egg. Spoon about 1.5 tablespoons of the brown butter hollandaise sauce over the top. Garnish with black pepper and serve immediately. This can be made ahead. To poach eggs in advance, you would poach as directed through step 5. Cooking for about 30 seconds less. Then immediately transfer the eggs to a large shallow bowl of cold water. Store the eggs in the water, covered in the refrigerator for up to 12 hours. Reheat your eggs in a saucepan of barely simmering water for about 1.5 minutes. Well, that ends our segment for this day. Thanks again for joining me, and I wish you a wonderful week ahead.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for Food and Stuff. The following recording is intended for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. My name is Gretchen Miller. Today we're going to start off with a recipe from smittenkitchen.com. Collard greens with cornmeal dumplings. One of my favorite cookbook purchases of the last year is Tony Tipton Martin's Jubilee, Recipes from Two Centuries of African American Cooking. It's one of those incredible books that even from the pages of the introduction, quietly but irrevocably pivots some of the ways you think about food. Tipton Martin talks about growing up in the Black Beverly Hills of Los Angeles, one of several communities in the U.S. that she says are rarely discussed in the media, an omission of Black, middle, and upper classes that serves to stereotype African Americans as poor, uneducated, and possibly dangerous. Growing up, she had a diversity, that was in quotes, by the way. Growing up, she had a diverse culinary upbringing with her mother's homegrown fruits and vegetables at the center. But she found that culinary heritage and the larger story of the African-American food that encompasses the middle class and well-to-do, quote, was lost in a world that confined the Black experience to poverty, survival, and soul food, end quote. She found it frustrating. With this book, she hoped to tell a multifaceted story of African-American food that includes but also looks beyond what people call Southern and soul. And that's just the introduction. For each recipe, head notes explain the historical roots of the dish, cookbooks and literature that lend greater understanding, and the ways creative cooks are treating it today. While I'd already heard great things about the baked barbecued beans, peach buttermilk ice cream, biscuits, Benne wafers, hope I'm pronouncing that right, B-E-N-N-E, I still found deciding what to cook first nearly impossible because Jarell Guy's magnificent photos make what is already delicious even more luxurious until I remembered that my husband had been patiently requesting that I make collard greens for, almost all of almost 17 years we've been together. I'm one of the women she mentions in the intro that didn't grow up eating a lot of greens, but I've come to like them as much as he does. Collards are, I've learned, spectacularly easy to grow, cook, and eat. They get sweet and almost silky after a long simmer. Traditional Southern, soul, or country-style greens, Tipton Martin calls them a totemic soul food dish, are often simmered for a long time until quite tender. In a broth of ham hocks and other aromatics called pot liquor, but she says they needn't be cooked forever, just until they're as tender as you like them. So this recipe provides a range. Choose the state of doneness that suits your taste and the greens that you have. Where I've been. It's off topic. It feels like oversight not to catch you up. I'd intended this recipe for the days leading up to July 4th to go with the ribs, cornbread, baked beans, and conversations about what America is versus what we would like it to be. But that weekend, the New York Times ran a piece they'd asked me to write about some thoughts I'd tweeted the week before about the binds that many of us are in as we head into a new school year. I've since been on Good Morning America, The Today Show, CNN, radio shows, and podcasts, on phone calls with teachers, unions, and child care advocacy organizations, and it's been an honor to get to speak up for the people, kids, parents, teachers, essential workers, I think are being hurt the most by lack of funding and job protections. But it's also been very surreal, not at all the July I was expecting to have, which involved more orzo salads, s'mores, socially distant sandwiches, and frozen drinks, naturally. But as it slows down, I'm excited to get back to talking about cooking, too. Here's the recipe. Collard greens with cornmeal dumplings. This serves six. It takes about 4 hours, mostly hands-off. The source is Jubilee by Tony Tipton Martin. I was unable to get ham hock or smoked turkey wings the week I made these in the more unevenly stocked months of the pandemic, and decided to use bacon, 8 ounces thick, cut in two-inch segments, instead for the smoky flavor. The broth doesn't have the depth of a broth made with bones, but the flavor was excellent. So for the smoky soul stock, You're going to need 2 smoked ham hocks or smoked turkey wings, see note, 2 medium onions, quartered, 4 celery stalks, including leaves, halved, 2 carrots, trimmed and quartered, 2 garlic cloves, peeled and smashed, 1/2 teaspoon of black peppercorns, 2 bay leaves. For the greens and dumplings, you're going to need 1.5 quarts of smoky sole stock that you just made above, 1/2 cup of chopped onion, 1 garlic clove minced, 1 pound of collard greens, 2 small dried red chili peppers, or 1 teaspoon crushed red pepper flakes. That's a lot. 3/4 teaspoon of salt, plus more to taste. I used 2 teaspoons of diamond in greens. Black pepper, 1/2 cup of all-purpose flour, 1.5 cups of coarsely ground cornmeal, 1 teaspoon of baking powder, and 1 teaspoon of granulated sugar, and 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter and salt to taste. So first you're going to make the smoky sole stock. In a large, heavy stock pot, bring 3 quarts of water, smoked meat, onions, celery, carrots, garlic, peppercorns, and bay leaves to a boil. Reduce the heat and simmer, partially covered, until the flavors are well blended, about 2 hours. The broth develops a stronger flavor the longer that you let it simmer. Remove the meat from the broth. When cool enough to handle, pull it off the bones, discard the skin, fat, and bones, chop the meat, and reserve for another use. Use a fine mesh sieve to strain the stock. Refrigerate the stock until the fat floats to the top, and then use a slotted spoon to skim off the fat and discard. Store the stock tightly covered in the fridge or freezer. Next, you're going to make the collard greens with cornmeal dumplings. In a saucepan, bring the stock, onion, and garlic to a boil over high heat. Reduce the heat, cover, and simmer while preparing the greens. Thoroughly wash the greens and trim away the stems if desired. Discard the stems or chop small. Stack 2 or 3 leaves on a cutting board and roll tightly into a log. Slice the greens crosswise into 1/4 inch wide ribbons. I love that part. Place the greens and the chilies in the broth and return to simmer. Cook covered for about 1.5 hours for very tender greens. You may cook them for less if you have young greens or prefer greens with more chew. Season to taste with salt and black pepper. Spoon out about 1 cup of the pot liquor, which is the cooking broth, and set aside. Meanwhile, in a small bowl, whisk together the flour, cornmeal, baking powder, sugar, and 3/4 teaspoon of salt. In a small saucepan, melt the butter. Add the reserved pot liquor and heat to just below boiling. Remove the pot liquor mixture from the heat and whisk 1/2 of it, about 1/2 cup, into the dry ingredients and more if needed. 1 tablespoon at a time. I needed almost the full cup to reach a thick batter consistency, by the way. And then you're going to let that stand for 5 minutes. When it's cool enough to handle, use wet fingertips, or in my case, a big scoop, to shape the dough into 6 dumplings. During the last 15 minutes of the collards cooking time, carefully drop the cornmeal dumplings into the pot with the greens, making sure that the dumplings rest in the pot liquor. Cover the pot and simmer until the dumplings are cooked through, 10 to 15 minutes. Sounds scrumptious. I wish I could, in fact, maybe I will make that for dinner tonight. So the next thing we've got here for you is an article from Goop.com. Something called What's Your Chronotype? There we go. Gretchen, Chronotype. What's your chronotype? Have you always known that you hit your stride in the evening? Or that despite early morning attempts, you tend to solve creative problems around 5 p.m.? According to Daniel H. Pink, the author of When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, there's research to show that your productivity pattern's not unusual. In fact, how you feel throughout the day can be somewhat predictable if you pay attention to the right details. The field of chronobiology is an attempt to understand biological rhythms of life and how they relate to psychology and economics. What these fields have together shown us is that our brain power doesn't remain static over the course of the day, Pink says. It changes in a significant way between daily peak brain functions and lowest brain function. Using this information, we can infer that the best time to do a certain activity depends on what that activity is, as well as your chronotype. Pink explains what a chronotype is and how to determine yours, and shares advice for the times you're most likely to be productive, creative, focused, and engaged. So here's a question and answer with Daniel H. Pink. First question, what are chronotypes? The answer, a chronotype is the label for people's innate biological rhythms. Whether they naturally go to sleep early and wake up early, a lark, or go to sleep late and wake up late, owls. Larks make up about 15% of the population, and owls make up about 20% of the population. The rest of us are somewhere in the middle, but lean in the lark direction. So, question, how can you determine your chronotype? Answer, there's a psychological instrument called the Morning Eveningness Questionnaire, MEQ, that you can take. There's also a simple back-of-the-envelope method. First, think of what chronobiologists call a free day, a day when you don't have to wake up at a certain time and you can go to sleep whenever you want. It's not the day after you just worked for 3 weeks and finally got a day off and are sleep deprived. Instead, you can control your schedule. What time would you wake up? What time would you go to sleep? Next, determine the midpoint of sleep. Let's say on a free day, you'd go to sleep at midnight and wake up at 8 a.m. Your midpoint of sleep would be 4 a.m. The general rule is that if your midpoint of sleep is before 3:30 a.m., you're probably a lark. If it's after 5:30 a.m., you're probably an owl. If it's between 3:30 and 5:30, you're in the middle. So in this example, you'd be larky, but not a full-fledged lark. So question, how does energy fluctuate during the day depending on your chronotype? Answer, we generally move through the day in three stages, a peak, a trough, and a recovery. For about 80% of us, the peak comes early in the day, the trough in the middle of the day, and the recovery in the late afternoon or early evening. But owls are different. They hit their peak much later in the day, early evening, mid-evening, or sometimes even later. Question, can this information help us determine when to plan certain activities? Answer, during the peak, we're highest in vigilance. We're hard to distract and have a generally positive mood. That makes the peak the ideal time for analytical work that requires head-down focus and attention, going over data, reviewing steps of a strategy, or writing a report. People perform this type of work better during their peak. The research isn't granular enough to give us specific times that are best, but for larks, this means trying to do analytical work in the morning. Owls are better off doing this type in the evening. Larks and owls perform very differently at 8 a.m. than they do at 8 p.m. There's also some interesting evidence that for many people, therapy sessions can be more effective in the morning than they are later in the day because they can see problems more analytically. Early to mid-afternoon during the trough, most people show big declines in mood and performance. For example, kids who take a standardized test in the afternoon score worse than students who take the same test in the morning. There are a disproportionate number of car accidents in the afternoon. Hospitals see huge drops in hand washing and significant increases in medical errors. During the trough, we should do things that don't require a lot of attention or creativity. It's a good time to send emails or tackle other administrative work. For most of us, the late afternoon and early evening is the recovery stage. Our mood goes back up, but our vigilance does not. This makes it a good time to solve what psychologists call insight problems. Insight problems don't bend to mathematical logic. They require greater mental looseness, creativity, and divergent thinking. Research has shown that if you give people who aren't night owls an insight problem, they're more likely to solve it around 5 p.m. than they are at 9 a.m. You can experiment with specific times for certain activities, but the general rule is to do your analytic work during the peak, your administrative work during the trough, and your insight work during the recovery. So if you're a writer, write during your own peak when your heart is to distract. If you're learning to play the piano or a new skill that requires attention, the peak is also the ideal time. But if you want to do a brainstorming session with your team, don't do it at 9 in the morning because most people will be more narrowly focused. Later in the day, when people loosen up mentally, is generally better. The key is to play around with timing and learn what works best for you. Question. What else has the research shown about the optimal time of day for certain activities? Answer. The best time to work out depends on your goals. Morning exercise seems to be the best for forming a habit, probably because you're less likely to be interrupted at 7 a.m. than you are at 4 p.m. But another strong argument for morning exercise is that aerobic exercise and weight training can give you a significant boost in your mood that can last 8 or so hours. If you exercise late in the day, you'll sleep through some of that mood boost. But by late afternoon or early evening, exercise is better for other goals. For example, you're less likely to get injured later in the day, possibly because the body temperature tends to peak then, and so people are more warmed up. People also report enjoying exercise most at this time of the day. There's really interesting evidence on performance and time of day. A disproportionate number of world records in speed events, such as speed skating, sprinting, and swimming, have all been set between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. local time. If you're a caffeine drinker, it's not a good idea to have caffeine first thing in the morning. When we wake up, our cortisol levels are still rising, and coffee can inhibit their climb. You're better off waiting until an hour and a half after waking when your cortisol levels start to fall to have your cup of coffee or tea and give yourself a boost. Daniel H. Pink is the best-selling author of 6 books, including When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Pink holds a JD from Yale Law School and formerly served as a chief speechwriter to Vice President Al Gore. This article is for informational purposes only, regardless of whether it features the advice of physicians and medical practitioners. It's not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and should never be relied on for specific medical advice. We're going to have another recipe from smittenkitchen.com. This one for roasted tomato soup with broiled cheddar. One of my favorite lunches ever is tomato soup with a grilled cheese sandwich with pickles inside. My mom used to make that for lunch, and I loved it. So this, lest you think I spend any part of my days doing important things, preparing and totally not at the last second or haphazardly for my only child's second birthday, this was written a while ago, or for his first week of preschool, assembling warm, wholesome meals for his lunch each day, meeting my manuscript deadline, dealing with a shoe bomb that went off in my closet, etc., it's only fair and honest that I tell you that I've spent a significant portion of the last year considering ways to merge grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato soup in a single vessel. I feel like I've like died and gone to heaven. This is awesome. In a way, though, it relates to all of those things. Well, not the shoes. There's something very back to schoolish about tomato soup and grilled cheese sandwiches. And because it's still September in the time this article was written, if you're lucky, you can still get some tomatoes worth eating. And if not that, at least worth cooking down. In my imagined intersections of grilled cheese and tomato soup, I dreamed of grilled cheese croutons in 1-inch rounds, but rejected it for being overly precious. I considered grilled cheese bread bowls, but never worked out the logistics. But it was when I revisited the ne plus ultra combination of cheese and soup, French onion soup, this past spring, that I knew unequivocally that the very best solution would be to simply broil an open-faced grilled cheese sandwich on top of a bowl of tomato soup. The only thing left to do was to wait and wait and wait for the slim overlap of tomato season, soup season, and a gloomy, rainy week. And that, my friends, brings us to today. Beautiful photos of the yummy soup and this beautiful bread. I remember not too long ago explaining all of the many reasons we believed we were not soup people. The monotony of every spoonful tasting like the one before, the way so many of them carried this boiled limp vegetable smell to them, and the fact that a good lot of them were oversalted to compensate for flavor shortages or veritable bombs of heavy cream to make up for lack of body. But the funniest thing happened right after that. We became them. Suddenly we had the tiniest perspective shift, and soup was not the enemy. It was our savior. It was something I could put up a big pot of a couple times a week and ensure us healthy meals that reheated perfectly. Nevertheless, I can't say we've ever reviewed our dinner options recently and said, "Yay, 3-day-old split pea soup," or "Sunday's Tuscan white beans." We're converted, but perhaps not reformed. But day-old soup with a broiled cheddar cheese lid? I absolutely cannot wait until dinner tonight. Here is the recipe for roasted tomato soup with broiled cheddar. I loosely adapted the tomato soup from an old Bon Appetit recipe, although more than quartering the oil, using less stock, no rosemary, and roasting rather than sautéing of the garlic cloves, and of course opening up a grilled cheese sandwich and broiling it on top. I think if the recipe could talk, it would forgive me. Oh, and by the way, there's a new note of January 2018. I just wanted to note in my second cookbook, Smitten Kitchen Every Day, I have an updated version of the soup with canned tomatoes since we eat it so often in the winter when the fresh tomatoes are underwhelming. So it can be done with canned tomatoes, too. This recipe serves 4, though it's closer to 6 if it's served in mugs. For the soup, you're going to need 3 pounds of plum tomatoes, halved lengthwise, 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 large or 4 small garlic cloves, unpeeled, 1 teaspoon of finely chopped fresh thyme leaves, or 1/4 teaspoon of dried, 1/4 teaspoon or more to taste of dried crushed red pepper, and 4 cups of chicken or vegetable stock. For the lid, you're going to need 4 1-inch slices from a large loaf of rye bread, whole wheat sourdough, or bread of your choice. Or you can have 16 1-inch slices from a baguette. Toast it until hard and lightly buttered on one side. You're going to need also 1 tablespoon of grated raw onion and 1 cup of coarsely grated cheddar or more to taste. To make the soup, you're going to preheat the oven to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, wrap garlic cloves in a tight foil packet, place tomatoes cut side up on a large baking sheet, sprinkle generously with salt and pepper. I used 1 full teaspoon of kosher salt. Drizzle the tomatoes with olive oil. Add a foil packet of garlic to the tray and roast until the tomatoes are brown and tender. The garlic will be very tender, and that's going to be about 1 hour. Cool slightly. Unwrap garlic packet, peel cloves, transfer cloves, tomatoes, and accumulated juices to a blender or food processor, and pulse the machine on and off until the tomatoes are a chunky puree. Transfer the tomatoes to a medium pot and add thyme, crushed red pepper, and stock, and bring to a boil. Reduce heat to a simmer and cook uncovered for 25 minutes. To create the cheddar lid, you're going to preheat the oven to 350, put 4 oven-proof soup bowls on a large foil-lined baking sheet, stir the grated onion into the warm soup, and float a toast slice in each bowl with the buttered side up, and divide the grated cheese generously over the top. Bake soups on tray for 15 to 20 minutes until cheese on top is bubbling and brown at the edges. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us today for Food and Stuff. My name is Gretchen Miller. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.
This is Bird Note. Loons are built for life in the water. They're streamlined and dense to pursue fish deep below the surface. Loons' legs are placed far back on their bodies, almost like propellers, a unique advantage for life on the lake. But those legs don't work well on land. That's why, if you see a loon on terra firma, something has probably gone wrong. During migration, loons sometimes mistake wet pavement for the reflective surface of deep water and try to land there. And once they've touched the ground, they're stuck. Loons can't walk more than a short distance, and they're so heavy that they need at least 100 feet of water to launch into the air. If you see a stranded loon on a road or parking lot, calling a wildlife rehabilitator can help start the process of returning that bird to safety and back on their migratory journey. Early spring is a good time to keep an eye out for them when loons are on the move and the weather is wet. By looking out for migrating loons, people can help ensure these submarine-like birds reach their northern breeding grounds safely. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.
Would you like to hear news from Blackstone Valley and Webster that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 5 p.m.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is My Shadow by Robert Louis Stevenson. I have a little shadow that goes in and out with me, and what can be the use of him is more than I can see. He is very, very like me, from the heels up to the head, and I see him jump before me when I jump into my bed. The funniest thing about him is the way he likes to grow, not at all like proper children, which is always very slow, for he sometimes shoots up taller, like an India rubber ball, and he sometimes gets so little that there's none of him at all. He hasn't got a notion of how children ought to play, and can only make a fool of me in every sort of way. He stays so close beside me, he's a coward, you can see. I think shame to stick to nursie as that shadow sticks to me. One morning, very early, before the sun was up, I rose and found the shining dew on every buttercup. But my lazy little shadow, like an arrant sleepy head, had stayed at home behind me and was fast asleep in bed. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Everyday, sponsored by Audio Journal. Read by me, Nikki Whichello. Thanks for listening. May your life be filled with poetic wonder.